add up the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves, my granny used to say.
Whoops, I guess granny didn't hear. No pennies anymore. Stephen Harper cut those too. But we'll take nickels. We'll take dimes. We'll take loonies and toonies and $5 bills and $50 bills and even $100 bills.
You can donate at rabble.ca/donate.
Rabble.ca/donate. Every little bit or every large bit helps.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
So as these plastics break down, they never really degrade down to nothing. They just degrade down to smaller and smaller molecules, and they get uptaken by a lot of living creatures. So all this stuff that we're taking off the beaches is important because it'll eventually end up out there anyways, and they eventually end up eating it. So either we take it off and put it in the dump now, or we end up eating it.
And there have been other studies around the world that have shown the many benefits of daylighting rivers, both as a cost-effective tool or also a tool for generating revenue in terms of tourism dollars.
Good afternoon and welcome to Habitat. I'm your host, Erica Butler, here with you for the next hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. A little field trip on Habitat today. We're going to head over to McNabb's Island for the McNabb's Island cleanup, which happened this past Sunday, June 1st. We'll take a little boat ride over, but first we talk Sawmill River. The Sawmill River in Dartmouth runs from Sullivan's Pond down into Halifax Harbor, a key piece of the Shubenacadie Canal system, and before that, the river system that was used to connect the Minas Basin with the Halifax Harbor. But you've probably never seen it, because for the past 40 years, it's been buried underground. Jocelyn Rankin is water coordinator at the Ecology Action Center. Welcome to Habitat, Jocelyn.
Hi, thank you.
So you're saying that right now we have a 1-in-100-year opportunity to daylight the Sawmill River. What are the factors that are coming together to make this opportunity?
Well, the most important factor is that the buried pipe where Sawmill River now flows underground needs to be replaced. So the culvert, which is a pipe basically, is too small for any kind of rain event or any kind of heavy rain event. So the Halifax Water Utility has recognized this as well as the city, and they need to fix it and replace it. So the biggest opportunity is that people, we're going to be working in that area and digging that pipe up anyway. So we say, while we're digging it up, why not replace it? A couple of other factors that are coming into this are that HRM currently has a policy on daylighting streams, and the policy basically says, where possible and feasible, we would like to move towards daylighting streams. There's also a process happening right now that's called the Shubenacadie Canal Greenway Project, and it's designed to put in more open space park land along the former Shubenacadie Canal. So what better asset to a park than an exposed or daylighted river?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly sounds promising.
Yeah.
There's actually some engineers at CBCL have actually done a concept sketch of that. Was that part of that Canal Greenway project?
Yes, that was part of the Canal Greenway project, and that CBCL report has some sketches and mock-ups of what the area could look like, and it includes a section of the river that is daylighted. So not the entire section, but a small section.
And I gather there's also a situation with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. Yeah, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans has required that the city and the water utility put in fish passage. And it's quite tricky to develop or engineer systems that allow fish to move upstream. And there's quite a gap in height that these fish have to move up. And so we feel a daylighted stream would be a really great opportunity, or be a really great way to allow fish passage.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard from fishers and anglers who have said that there are a lot of fish ladders that aren't working. So instead of putting in something that's not going to work really well or actually won't facilitate fish movement or migration, why not put in an open canal or open stream?
Yeah. Now, an open stream as opposed to a culvert, How do they mean fish when they're looking at sort of a dark enclosed culvert to go upstream versus an open? Like, if they, I guess they would be looking at the same uphill climb either way, but what's the advantage for the fish with a daylighted stream?
Yeah, so if you imagine or can picture a culvert in your head, it's a long pipe, and it's really hard for fish to swim against a current for a long time over this long distance of pipe. But a daylighted stream can have different types of habitat, like riffles and pools, or more of a canal section, and more of like perhaps rocky channels. So that diversity of riverbed allows for better spots, or just a more diverse set of spots where fish can actually stop and rest on their migratory climb upstream.
I see, yeah. When I heard about this fish ladder business, it also occurred to me that I wonder if, you know, it's actually simpler and possibly more cost effective to just daylight this river, if that's what we need to do, get the fish up the stream, as opposed to trying to, you know, do this underground engineering and create this sort of technology that's going to do what sort of a natural stream does so well already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not an expert in sort of costing out engineering studies. There's quite a lot to it, but by giving a river back its natural course and its natural shoreline, you're kind of letting nature do the job itself, and there would be some maintenance involved, but by having it exposed to daylight and not burying it, it would seem to be fairly cost effective, and certainly a lot less requirement for heavy infrastructure. And there have been other studies around the world that have shown the many benefits of daylighting rivers, both as a cost-effective tool or also a tool for generating revenue in terms of tourism dollars, and also the environmental benefits.
Mm-hmm. The river was originally put underground in 1971 after a major flood. How would the daylighting of that channel, and I mean, now obviously it's too narrow a pipe, which makes me think it must have been narrow for the past 30 years as well. But how would that, you know, can daylighting, I mean, that makes it sound as if burying it is a safety precaution. But as we saw, you guys screened a film, Lost Rivers, last night at the Mi'kmaq Aquatic Center. And one of the points made in the film is that, you know, some people are saying that, you know, daylighting a river and giving room for rivers to flood, giving some green space for, you know, to absorb floodwaters is probably a smarter solution than trying to engineer floodproof waterways underneath our cities. Do you have any idea about like how the daylighting will affect the risk of damages in case of floods?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of points I can say to that question. The first is that climate change is happening, and we are forecasting more intense and severe rain events. So when our conveyance systems are buried underground, or when we have a lot of rainwater washing through these buried pipes, there's a risk for them to back up because they just simply can't take all that water at once. And so daylighting a river potentially can allow for more water to flow. But as you say, rivers naturally flood their banks every once in a while, and by having dedicated green space to allow some of that water to flood over in a way that's safe and won't harm public or private infrastructure, then it's doing its job as it would in nature. The trouble here is that we have a fairly densified urban environment, and trying to find those spaces for the river to flood its banks in the 1 in 100 year rain event, that might be a little bit tricky, not impossible. And part of the land that's along that Shubenacadie Canal area is owned by the municipality. So presumably the municipality could allow for dedicated sort of areas for the river to flood into.
What is the situation politically around this? Have you heard any support for the idea from city councillors?
We have heard some support in email correspondence. Counselor in Dartmouth, Gloria McCluskey, mentioned that she did support daylighting Sawmill River. And another counselor, Counselor David Hensby, he also expressed some interest in daylighting another river in Dartmouth. So I think the idea has sort of sparked in a few counselors' minds. In some meetings with Halifax Water, they aren't yet convinced. So I think, you know, we can have some more conversations with them. But there are many other people that are involved in this Canal Greenway project, developers, canoe and kayak enthusiasts, Mi'kmaq people who live in the area or who want to see fish passage restored, and the Shubenacadie Canal Commission. So there are a lot of players, and I think everybody kind of has a bit different perspective on the issue, and we're trying to find common ground related to the idea of having a vibrant and revitalized corridor of green and blue space, blue in the sense of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's also, I mean, it seems like a lot of, so much development happening right around that area. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it, you know, it could be a very positive thing for, you know, even the developers around that area to invest in.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we're hoping to meet with some of the developers for, like, the Dartmouth Waterfront Development Corporation and King's Wharf, and talk to them about this idea and see if we can get some support from them as well.
Mm-hmm. Have we ever daylighted a river in Halifax, do you know?
That's a great question. There's been a lot of talk about it. I don't think we've actually ever daylighted any river in HRM. The other river that sometimes comes to mind is Freshwater Brook, and that crosses through Dartmouth Common, sort of flows through parts of the city. In fact, the little pond in the public gardens is partly fed by Freshwater Brook, and then it used to empty out into the Halifax Harbor down at the bottom of English Street. I know a couple of students have done a research for their master's project to see whether it would be feasible to expose or daylight parts of Freshwater Brook. That hasn't come to light yet, but it would be a really interesting and unique project for a city such as ours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that runs right through the commons, does it not?
Exactly, yeah.
And we might be looking at, I guess, eventually, or very soon, they'll be looking at reimagining the commons, or so I hear. I hear murmurs of that. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens. I gather the skate park used to be a pond.
That's right, yeah. Yes. It's a pond called Egg Pond.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. An interesting history of our city, buried underground.
Yeah. The film last night, Lost Rivers, documented some precedents. What are some highlights from, like, you know, the stuff you've seen in the film or things you've heard about happening in other cities?
Yeah, one of the most amazing highlights is from a city in New York State called Yonkers. And coincidentally, the river that they daylighted there is also called Sawmill River. So that's kind of a funny coincidence. But yeah, I mean, they had some investment from the state, from the federal government, and from the city government to invest in daylighting that river. And it was really neat to see in the film kind of how that, what that looked like. And it was a lot of heavy infrastructure. And one of the questions or comments from somebody in the audience said that it doesn't actually have to be that expensive or that complicated. You know, some smaller streams or creeks have been daylighted, and it's pretty cost effective and doesn't take quite as much work or investment. So that was a neat one, and it was interesting to hear of the missed opportunity to daylight Garrison Creek in Toronto, too, in the film, where some architects, landscape architects, were really pushing for exposing that river in part of the Garrison Valley way, I guess you could say, in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a really great film. I would recommend to all your listeners to check it out. But yeah, I mean, those were some examples that really struck me.
All right. Where can people find out more about Sawmill River, Dartmouth Sawmill River? If you Google Sawmill River, as you pointed out, you're going to find a lot of pictures of Yonkers.
That's right, yeah.
So make sure you add Dartmouth to the equation, Sawmill River, yeah. Dartmouth. Where can people find out more, or how are you recommending that people show support for this idea? I gather it's like, it's imminent, right? I mean, they're going to have to replace this infrastructure, these culverts soon, yeah. Within the next year or so, it sounded like.
Yeah.
So what are you recommending that people do if they want to support this idea?
The first thing that we're recommending people to do is talk to their municipal councillors and let them know what they think. We don't yet have a website set up for the Daylighting Sawmill River project. We'd like to. We don't have a lot of funding yet, but you can encourage your listeners to contact me. I'm the water coordinator at the Ecology Action Center. My email address is water@ecologyaction.ca. You can also connect with the Ecology Action Center on Facebook and on Twitter. And we are also going to be having a booth at the Open Street Switch event in Dartmouth on June 15th. So check us out. We're going to be near Sullivan's Pond. And we can chat more about it at that point and find out how folks want to get more involved.
All right. Thanks very much, Jocelyn. I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Erica.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray.
This past Sunday, I hopped on a boat along with 170 other volunteers, headed to McNabb's Island for the annual cleanup. The cleanup is organized every year by the Friends of McNabb Society, who are essentially the island's caretakers. Although it became a provincial park in 2002, McNabb's is what the Department of Natural Resources calls a non-operational park, meaning they neither promote it nor service it. In addition to fundraising for things like trail maintenance, shelters, and composting toilets, the Friends organize this cleanup, designed to get rid of some of the debris and garbage that accumulates on McNabb's beaches every year. You wouldn't believe how many plastic items you can find in a small stretch of beach. Everything from toothpaste caps to plastic straws to tampon applicators. Oh, so many tampon applicators. Here's some of the sounds and voices of the McNabb's Island cleanup.
Everybody listen up then. This is important. Okay, no one wants to be left on McNabb's Island, do they? Yes or no? Okay, what's the most important thing? Remember to come back and get the boat. This boat will be leaving McNabb's at 5, so I want you all to be back in plenty of time to catch the boat. So that means you should be back at Garrison Pier by 4:30, no later than that. And we are going to break up into groups when we get over there. We've had just absolutely amazing weather the last couple of days, and we have amazing weather today, which is really wonderful considering what a miserable winter we had. One thing that this miserable winter brought us was a lot of garbage on McNabb's Island. The beaches are just littered with garbage from all those storms we had over the winter. And there's very little garbage that actually gets brought over by people, by careless people who might be over there partying or something. Most of the garbage washes up on the beaches. And you're going to find some really interesting things. So if you do find something interesting, you know, either keep it if it's a small thing and show it to us later. Take a picture of it if it's a big thing, because we can use those pictures for our newsletter. And we'll be keeping track of what sort of garbage items, interesting garbage items that you've collected. One thing I should mention too is about about the tides, because the tide is rising, so that means that you need to make sure you leave all your garbage bags well above the high water mark. And the high water mark is where the seaweed is, if you don't know. And as far as things to pick up, leave all wood and anything that's organic on the beach, but pick up everything else. There'd be lots of plastic, there'd be lots of Tim Hortons cups, lots of old fishing gear, plastic bags, all kinds of plastic junk.
Mind if I ask you a few questions?
Sure, go ahead. Go ahead.
First of all, what's your name?
Sir, my name is Patrick McManus.
Is this your first year doing the cleanup, or have you done it before?
Fourth year.
Fourth year?
Yeah.
Wow. So what kind of stuff did you find today?
Well, we got a separate bag. That's our perennial favorite there, the tampon applicators.
Wow, you separate them.
Well, I just do out of curiosity, because I know that we tend to pick up a lot of them. Not as many this year as there have been in past years. Last year, for some reason, I don't know why, we kept finding them in groups of five. But it's down this year, which I think is a good sign. And actually, because I worked this is the third time I've worked this beach, I think there is less garbage. I think there is not as much. We certainly don't seem to have as much big stuff as we had. We found a barrel off a Russian ship last year, a couch and a TV. Those stuff, though, they tell me is something that people just tend to put on their boat, bring it over here, and then drop it on the beach late at night. So it's not something that necessarily floated here.
I see. Yeah.
And as for this stuff, it does come from our sewage system. I did ask a friend who deals with that, and he said it's precisely because it's plastic.
Yeah.
Their system is used to dealing with heavy solids sinking to the bottom, whereas this stuff tends to float, gets missed by the skimmers, gets flushed out into the system, which means not everything we put back into the ocean is, after being treated, is necessarily clean.
Oh, really? So
yeah.
You think that a lot of these tampon applicators are like new? Or I was just postulating that maybe they're just decades old.
Oh, and you can have that as well, and you are going to have that because they're floating out there.
Yeah,
it can take a while for it to come back, but you've got some that are obviously like new.
Yeah, they don't look. Yeah, some don't look very weathered at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Why? How did you first come to join the cleanup, and why do you do it?
Well, I'm with a hiking group, the Halifax Outdoor Adventurers. We've been over the island many times for hiking and camping. I used to come here when I was younger, and I was noticing too, at least because the first time I came over here was about 40 years ago, the harbor is actually cleaner than it used to be. There was a time you actually could not see through the water, because especially all the oil that used to float on it, because it used to be, there was no law against ships dumping whatever they wanted over the side when they came into harbor. So I still wouldn't want to necessarily go swimming in an industrial harbor, but it's cleaner than it used to be. But the island over the years, actually compared to now, was actually a lot more pristine than it is. And it may have been because there were people living on it. And it's kind of sad to see all the garbage. This is what we've noticed from the hikes over the years, all the garbage that you find, not only here, but also deep in the woods.
Right.
And so, they said this is just something we do with the Friends of McNabb's Island every year. I don't know, a good way to at least pick things up a bit.
All right, I'll let you get back to it.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Hello in here.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
My name's Eric Butler. Can I ask you a few questions?
Sure.
What's your name?
Rael.
Rael, nice to meet you. Maybe just tell me what you're picking up there.
Just anything I can find. Mostly foam, styrofoam, plastics, stuff like that. Anything I can find.
Yeah. How long have you been doing the?
This is my fourth year.
Okay. And why do you do it?
For fun.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I find it very enjoyable, great to meet a lot of people, and at the same time, it's doing a lot of good.
Yeah. What kind of stuff have you picked up today?
Mostly bottle, rope, styrofoam, a lot of styrofoam.
Yeah.
Anything that'll float.
Yeah. And how far back, I mean, you know, I'm used to seeing garbage along the beach. How far back into the woods have you been finding the garbage?
Well, I only go about 10, 15 feet, but you could probably go a lot further than that if you wanted to.
Yeah.
The wind will blow in quite far sometimes, strong mm-hmm. winds. If I see something big, I'll go get it. Other than that, I try to stick to the shore.
Have you noticed changes over the years that you've been...
Yes, I have.
Yeah, what sort of changes?
The first year I was here, the pile we had was over my head. And yeah. It's gone down quite a bit now.
What do you think what do you think accounts for that?
People doing this every year.
Oh, okay. So it's slowly reducing the amount that's staying on the island.
Right, we're getting a lot of the big stuff. Now it's more a lot of small stuff that keeps blowing in.
All right, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
My name is Jonathan Cusick. My background is marine biology.
Oh, great.
So I've spent a lot of time in ocean and ocean issues and stuff. But this is the macro stuff that we're seeing on the beaches, right? I mean, it's trash you can actually visibly see, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. Don't get me wrong. It's fantastic cleaning stuff up because it eventually breaks down anyways. That's probably the biggest problem is that the breakdown, and that's where you're talking about the big gyres out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff's micro. You don't see it at this level. So as these plastics break down, they never really degrade down to nothing. They just degrade down to smaller and smaller molecules, and they get uptaken by a lot of living creatures. And a lot of living creatures and the fish take it as part of their things, and we end up eating our own plastic because we fish that we eat the tuna, right? Eventually gets into the tuna. So all this stuff that we're taking off the beaches is important because it'll eventually end up out there anyways, and they eventually end up eating it. So either we take it off and put it in the dump now, or we end up eating it.
Yeah.
This is a huge issue, I think, for at least for these kids, right? That's what I'm worried about, is the kids eventually. So, anyways, I'm sorry, I'm going to rant.
No, it's interesting because you can see, I guess, lots of different degrees of degradation in the plastic.
Exactly.
You can pick up.
Yep, and it, very much so. And get along the beach, they get broken up in the wave action, and a lot of the high energy beaches will break it up into little bits, and eventually it'll get into the ocean or get uptaken by things along the beach, fish along the coast, all that kind of stuff. So, if society makes a big push. And I think some people are kind of aware of it, but you'd be surprised how things eventually get down to the coast and get incorporated into the actual... Everything ends up in the ocean. Everything ends up in the ocean. So anything you put on land eventually is going to end up there somehow. Either broken down, getting down through into the streams, or as a piece of plastic actually floating out in the river. It happens. So you've got to make the conscious effort, no matter where you live, of actually trying to put that in a safe place where you can actually put it away, or... Better yet, let's get rid of plastic altogether and go back to glass and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Plastics do have an advantage, right? So, anyways, yeah.
Right, yeah. You can safely leave the glass on the beach here and it'll...
And it breaks down, you get these beautiful things, and eventually beach is sand, or glass is sand, mm-hmm. right? It is just a different type of silicon that actually puts it together. But plastics, totally different ballgame. So... And you drop a bottle in the store and it's a plastic bottle, it won't break. Well, it's great, right? But then again... I mean, there's a cost to everything, right? So, yeah.
I've been a member of the Friends of McNabs for going on 10 years, I think. And they do the cleanup every year. And I started helping them sort of organize a portion of it about 5 years ago with the outdoor group that we are part of, the Halifax Outdoor Adventures. And I sort of am hosting two groups here today. It's the Halifax Outdoor Adventures and the geocaching group. And both of them have participated in a lot of cleanups. And this is my favorite island, so I always help them out every year.
Do you hike a lot on McNabs?
I do, actually. And I do a lot of tours on McNabs as well. I have been doing that for years. I really love it. It has a lot of history to it. It has a lot of really what I consider to be exciting, magical, hidden, secret places. It's just a fantastic island. It really is what people call it, the jewel of Halifax.
Yes. Or the green jewel.
Yes, that's it, the green jewel. Yeah.
Over the years that you've been doing it, have you noticed a change in what kind of garbage you're seeing on the coast, or how much garbage you're seeing?
I haven't myself. I actually think it's probably about the same. That's just my personal opinion. But then again, I didn't get heavily involved in the cleanup until about 4 or 5 years ago. So I didn't see it when they first started doing it. So I don't know what it was like then. I haven't noticed a huge change. I mean, there seems to always be garbage here. I actually don't attribute that to anything more than the ocean has a tendency to collect these things, and it does end up here because this is like the filter for the Halifax Harbour. So I think no matter how much we try, there's always going to be stuff washing up here. It's the same as every coastal beach, really. So it just needs to be cleaned up every year. You know, it's just something that's going to happen. There's too much built up in the oceans in general, and, you know, the way it moves is just always going to collect here no matter what. There's tons on the ocean floor everywhere, right? So I don't blame it on any one person or industry or thing. That's just me. It's everyone. It's everything. It's how we live. It's how careless we all are in general about garbage.
Why do you keep coming out every year?
I love it. It's a really good day. For me personally, it's always a surprise gift. You never know what's going to happen. It's not just about cleaning garbage for me. It's about the people that you meet, the experiences that you have when you're here. I personally always get a prize. There's always some neat piece of garbage that I end up taking home. I'm absolutely serious.
What did you get this year?
This year, I have my own boat, and I came on my own boat that I have tied up on Garrison Pier. And so this year, Patrick found a sign that said something about no fuel on board, as in no open flames on board. And I just thought that would be really, really funny to attach to my boat. So that was a minor thing to pick up. But previous years, I have found mooring balls that normally would be very expensive if I had to buy it for my boat. And I found various other things like equipment for my boat that I can use. So for me personally, I always feel like I actually get paid to do the cleanup in every way. And like I said, you just never know who you're going to meet, the people. I just love it. So it's a secret gift. I never feel like I actually do it for nothing.
How much garbage did you pick up?
A lot.
Yeah. What kind of stuff did you find?
Me and my friend Angel, we found a deer skin.
That's kind of a weird thing to find.
Yeah.
But that's a natural thing. So, yeah, it got left there. Yeah. What kind of garbage were you finding?
A wrench.
A wrench?
Uh-huh. And a lot of plastic bags.
I found a lot of stuff that I'm surprised that was here. I found a tire.
Wow.
I saw about 3 tires all together today.
Really?
One of them was like a giant Toyota, and 2 of them were like probably for like little cars.
I found one that was like for a tractor, and I can't get out.
Oh, no.
They haven't been there for like 3 years.
Were you surprised at how much garbage you found on the beach when you were looking?
We didn't actually find much this year.
Oh, really?
We probably found like about...
There's not much garbage.
That's good.
We probably found like 10 bags.
Huh. And how much did... Were you here last year?
Yeah.
How much did you find last year?
Last year, there was like a lot. I believe Rosanna said that altogether was about 200 or something.
Oh, wow. Have you seen the big pile they're making out there?
Yep.
Is that similar to last year?
No, much bigger. No.
Last year was much bigger.
Yeah.
Yep.
So why did you guys decide to come out and help clean up McNabb's today?
Because we take action and we help the world.
Awesome.
Take action in your society.
What's that?
Take action in your society.
Go ahead.
People really need to start taking care of the world because... They're just killing it with all kinds of garbage going everywhere, isn't it? It'll just become a big wasteland.
That was sounds and voices from the McNabb's Island cleanup on Sunday, June 1st at the McNabb's Island Provincial Park in Halifax Harbor. The kids' voices you heard were all from a group called Take Action, from the community surrounding Harborview Elementary School in Dartmouth. You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and ravel.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca or check us out on Twitter @habitatradio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.